Chapter 16. Jumping In at the Shallow End. One of the first things I did in Calcutta was to contact Banerjee. We met at the Institute of Culture, where I introduced him to Kantaraj. On his return from Singapore, he had bought a partnership in a small retail coal business, on behalf of which he travelled in and around Calcutta in quest of orders. Ever rapid in transition from one extreme to the other, he now denounced politics as a menace to society and declared that religious and cultural activities alone constituted the true means of India's upliftment. Here at last was common ground. But though we discussed long and earnestly the question of the kind of life we proposed to lead together and the type of work to which we aspired to dedicate our energies, in the face of the vast difference which existed between our respective temperaments and backgrounds, it was impossible for us to come to any immediate conclusion. I wanted to work for Buddhism and, if possible, become a Buddhist monk. He, for all his repudiation of social orthodoxy, was still at heart very much the Bengali Brahmin, and his appreciation of Buddhism was in my eyes nullified by his point-blank refusal to consider it anything but a branch of Hinduism. In this he was by no means guilty of mere intransigence. Like all English-educated caste Hindus, the depth of his emotional commitment to Hinduism was so great that he belonged to it even when he rebelled against it, so that to repudiate it for the sake of another religion would have meant tearing up roots such as no one born into a more youthful and secularized tradition can imagine. However much Buddhism may appeal to him, no caste Hindu finds it easy to renounce his 3,000 years of cultural and spiritual tradition, especially when that tradition affirms his own sacred innate priority over the untouchable mass. Small wonder, then, that in an attempt to make the best of both worlds, he should maintain, against all evidence, that Buddhism and Hinduism are one. Years later, in a heroic act of renunciation, Banerjee cut himself free from all such emotional entanglements. Meanwhile, as we argued at the Institute, the problem of the next step to be taken remained unsolved. So for the time being, he continued his quest for customers, while I remained with Uncle Dick. Despite my 3 years in the army, I found the pleasures of family life thoroughly insipid. My last month in European society was in fact memorable for the disgust rather than the delight it inspired. At the Saturday Club, where I dined one night with Uncle Dick and his friends, a member described how an Anglo-Indian dancer had been stabbed to death in her bath by an Indian servant and then raped. The coarse jests which followed nauseated me. "Your nephew doesn't seem to like our stories," sneered the narrator of the incident to Uncle Dick. From Audrey's brother-in-law, a high-ranking police officer, I heard a story which I liked even less, and which made me ashamed of being English. It concerned the Dhaka communal riots which had occurred more than 20 years earlier. In great detail, and with every evidence of satisfaction, Dave described how, step by step, agents provocateurs had stirred up Hindu against Muslim, Muslim against Hindu, until half the city had been set ablaze and hundreds murdered. Much as the story shocked me, I was still more horrified by the laughter which followed. Uncle Dick, Audrey, and Audrey's sister Gladys were kindly, good-natured people. But Dave's story of how the police, in order to prevent the two Indian communities from forming a united front against the government, had resorted to tactics which can be described only as vile, seemed to fill them with nothing but amusement. Did they, then, have a double standard of morality, one for use among themselves, the other to be employed in dealing with Indians? The longer I stay with Uncle Dick, the more ethical questions of this sort perplex me. I was also troubled by problems of philosophy. What was the nature of causality? How was true knowledge possible, and in what did it consist? From questions such as these, which hammered on my brain as remorselessly as the falling of water drops on the head in the famous Chinese water torture, which eventually drives its victim mad, I was distracted by an unexpected turn in events. Several years before, the Institute had published a 3-volume work entitled The Cultural Heritage of India. This having gone out of print, a revised edition in 7 volumes was being planned. One day the Secretary Swami, who had some inkling of my aspirations and wanted to attach me more closely to the mission, spoke to me about this project and made a proposal. Would I like to live with them and assist in the preparation of the new edition? Though I should have preferred to work with a Buddhist organization, the proposal was not without its attractions. Kantaraj, Sanyal, and several other inmates of the Institute were my friends. The type of work in which I was being asked to collaborate was extremely congenial. Besides, did not the Swami's offer, which was communicated in a graceful and friendly manner, afford a means of escape from the mingled boredom and disgust of life with Uncle Dick and Audrey into the infinitely richer and more ample life of the real India? Might it not eventually provide a cultural springboard from which to leap and lose myself in the waters of the life spiritual? The only difficulty was my relation with Balaji, which had rapidly developed into a strong mutual attachment. Like the blind man and the lame man in the parable, we complemented each other to such an extent that neither felt capable of moving without the other. Besides, Banerjee had been cheated by his partner, and being as disgusted with business as I was with the social life of the English in India, was ready to devote himself to some kind of religious or cultural activity. Why should we not work together for the Institute? The Secretary Swami, to whom I put this counter-proposal, at first demurred that my friend would not be of much use in a purely literary undertaking. But when I urged on him Banerjee's willingness to be of service, and when he understood it would not be possible to have one of us without the other, he agreed that the arrangement should be given a trial. After taking my aunt, uncle and cousins out for a farewell dinner, I therefore shifted to the Institute. From then onwards I had no connections whatever with the European community. As no separate room was available to us at the Institute, Banerjee and I slept on the floor of the sitting room. One night I awoke to see an evil face with a knife gripped between the teeth, peering at me through the window. Though I saw the face for only a few seconds, it created a strong impression, reminding me of all the dark and hostile forces that were lurking outside our small self-contained world of religious and cultural activities, waiting for an opportunity to break in. Thereafter our bedding was unrolled on the floor of the inner room I used as an office. To keep me occupied until work on the Cultural Heritage of India was started, the Secretary Swami gave me letters to type. He also asked me to prepare the annual report of the Institute. Though such tasks were not uncongenial to me, I could not help feeling irritated at his method of work. Often a whole afternoon was spent over a single line of writing. Thus the work advanced with a slowness that my youthful impatience found extremely exasperating. Banerjee, who was trying to extract money from his former partner, was out most of the day. In the evenings we discussed religion. More often than not, he harangued the dozen or so student inmates of the Institute about politics, while I read St. John of the Cross or Meister Eckhart. Once, in fulfilment of a promise made in Singapore, He took me 20 miles out of Calcutta to the Bengali village, all coconut palms and fish ponds, where his widowed mother lived with his uncles, brothers, sisters, cousins, and various other members of their large joint family. This was the first time I had stayed in an Indian household. It was also the first time Banerjee's home had admitted a European guest. 7 years earlier, he told me, his mother could never have brought herself to tolerate my unclean presence. But the war had to some extent broken down the old rigid social barriers. Now she actually welcomed me. True, I was not allowed into the kitchen, and Banerjee was desperately anxious that I should make a show of carrying water with me whenever I went to the latrine, toilet paper being regarded as an abomination. But despite such vestiges of Hindu orthodoxy, I felt quite at home in the peaceful atmosphere of the asymmetrical tiled cottage with its cow-dunged floor, large wooden bed platforms, and shining brassware. Only subsequently did I learn that their allowing me to stay with them was an act of social heresy for which Banerjee's family ran the risk of being ostracized by the whole village. The fact that I had taken food in the house automatically polluted not only the building itself, but every occupant. Until the prescribed ceremonies of purification had been undergone, no caste Hindu could enter the house or touch any object that had been touched by a member of the household without becoming polluted in turn. To the Orthodox Hindu, pollution is as tangible and contagious as leprosy. By what means the village was placated after my departure, I do not know, but there is little doubt that my visit cost the ladies of the family at least several ceremonial ablutions. Since the typing and drafting I did for the Swami occupied only a small part of my time, I was free to go out as much as I liked. Towards the end of February, when I had been nearly a month at the Institute, Kantaraj took Banerjee and me to Belermath for Shivaratri, the night of Shiva, a festival observed especially by ascetics, whose patron the god Shiva is considered to be. In accordance with custom, the Swami spent the whole night singing and dancing round a great bonfire. On a tiger-skin-covered throne not far from the blaze sat a naked, ash-smeared figure with long matted hair. At intervals, he rose to his feet and pranced round the fire, waving his trident and shouting, "Shambhu! Shambhu!" in loud, raucous tones. Kantaraj whispered to me that this was Shiva. According to Western conceptions, it was merely a Swami impersonating the deity. But Hindus believe that he actually takes possession of the impersonator, who is therefore honoured for one night as Shiva himself. Certainly the awe-inspiring figure with the trident was not human. Perhaps it was a case of mediumistic possession, similar to that of the Tibetan oracles. A concoction of bhang or hemp, being used throughout India by sadhus to induce this condition, was flowing freely, and Shiva had no doubt imbibed it plentifully. Despite the remonstrances of Kantaraj, who feared it would make me drunk, a group of youthful novices pressed on me a glass of sour, greyish-white liquid, with the laughing assurance that it was only milk. However, the drink produced no ill effect. At 2 o'clock I went to bed, leaving the Swami shouting and singing round the bonfire. Next day Shiva was again an ordinary monk. There was also time for visits to the Mahabodhi Society. One day the bhikkhu in charge, who seemed to live almost alone in the headquarters building, asked me to type some letters. On another occasion he sent us to Writer's Building on official business. Before long we were spending as much time for the Society's work as for that of the Institute. One day His Holiness, as the bhikkhu informed us he should be styled, asked us in an almost uncouthly abrupt manner why we did not join the society as full-time workers. We could see for ourselves how short-handed they were, he said, and the General Secretary, who is in Ceylon, would undoubtedly agree gladly to our enrolment. Though the offer did not take us by surprise, Banerjee and I did not feel like giving His Holiness a reply before we had time to consult Cantor Raj. With life at the Institute, we were, for several reasons, dissatisfied. There was no sign of the editorial work being started. As a matter of fact, it did not start until years afterwards. Moreover, Banerjee, who was almost pathologically sensitive to slights, both real and imagined, had become convinced that the Secretary Swami despised him as one who, having failed to make a success of either politics or business, had taken refuge with me at the Institute because he had no alternative. His loud, emphatic assertion of how distinguished his family was and how successful he could be if he cared only excited the very suspicions they were meant to crush and made him look ridiculous. My protest that no one at the Institute despised him only infuriated him. Being myself respected, he said, I did not care if he was not. Whatever the Secretary Swami's true feelings might have been, it had become clear that if for me there was little work at the Institute, for Banerjee there was none at all, and that his presence was tolerated only on my account. But the real explanation for our decision to quit lay in an incident that had occurred some days earlier. The premises the Institute occupied in Wellington Square were not its own. A Bengali couple, however, had donated in memory of their son a large block of flats in Russo Road. Here, when the building had been remodelled, was to be located the Institute's permanent home. Meanwhile, eviction suits had been filed against the tenants, most of whom refused to budge until they had found alternative accommodation. Saroj, a plump, jolly novice of 37, who had been a solicitor, was in charge of these proceedings. One morning we found him weeping bitterly in the sitting room. The Secretary Swami, he explained between sobs, exasperated by the law's delay, had ordered him to hire a gang of hooligans and drive out the tenants by force. In vain he had fallen on his knees and pleaded that he had joined the mission to purify himself of sins, not to commit fresh ones. The Swami was adamant. By foul means, if fair ones were of no help, the tenants must be dislodged. Banerjee and I were deeply distressed. The students, none of whom liked the Swami, denounced him indignantly. Cantor Raj was silent. Saroj was still sobbing bitterly when he was again summoned upstairs to the Swami's room. 2 hours later, dry-eyed, but with an expression of intense misery on his face, he reappeared, took his umbrella from the stand, and without a word slowly went out, as usual, to the lawyer's office. Later it transpired that the Secretary Swami had given him a good lecture on Nishkama Karma Yoga, or disinterested action, as a means to God-realization. Referring to the Bhagavad Gita, the famous dialogue between Sri Krishna, the incarnate Godhead, and his disciple Arjuna, he had reminded Saroj that pity was a weakness to be overcome. The Atman, the Spirit, was one and indestructible in all men. Who then could hurt another? Who be hurt? Had not Sri Krishna himself exhorted Arjuna to fight and slay? One who performed his duty, whatever that might be, with mind fixed on God, committed no sin. In fact, such disinterested performance of duty constituted one of the four great paths to salvation. This sermon opened my eyes to the sinister implications of Hindu philosophy. and I recoiled from the mission like one who, when a lamp is lit, sees that he'd been about to step on a snake in the dark.